everybody. I'm Dana Kennedy. I'm an alcoholic. Good evening, Blue Ridge Speakers Group. Wow, I feel surreal to be here tonight, standing here, because I'm usually sitting on the back row over there. So my sobriety date is November the 14th, 2008. That is not my first sobriety date, and I'll talk a little bit about that tonight. I fought this thing for a very long time, and I'm very grateful to be standing here tonight sober and happy. And that's a result of doing what was suggested to me in this program. I was talking to Sam a little bit. Thank you, Sam, by the way, for inviting me to share here tonight. I was talking to him a little bit before the meeting. I got here extra early tonight. I was saying that usually I'm a regular attender of this meeting. I come every Sunday. Usually I come with my hair in a ball cap, wet, ripped jeans, T-shirt, and rolling in on two wheels. So it's very different for me to be standing up here tonight sharing with you. But it is an honor to be asked to participate in my own recovery. When I was drinking on a daily basis, I didn't participate in much. I preferred you to do it for me, as a matter of fact. That was the way I operated. So, anyway, in the last couple of days, I had some things happen. Nothing monumental, but I had some things happen that reminded me that there's always room for improvement in my spiritual conditioning. So just a little reminder that there's always room for improvement here. There's always a little reminder that I always need to have that loving God of my understanding that I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So anyway, I'm going to tell you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And so we'll get started from the very beginning. Came from a very loving home with two really good parents. My mother and father are not alcoholics. They are both children of alcoholics, though. One from a very violent alcoholic father, my father, and the other one from an alcoholic father who just kind of wasn't really present. And that has nothing to do with my alcoholism. It just is what it is. And both of my parents provided a very loving home where we were given every opportunity to thrive, succeed, and prosper in life, and there was nothing that they didn't give us to grow and succeed. So we also were raised in the home with my grandmother, and my grandfather died, my mother's mother. And my grandfather died when we were really young children. So I do have a brother. For those of you that don't know me, he is also a recovering alcoholic. My parents have two children. We're both drunks, recovering drunks. So we've run our parents through the ringers, but thank God we're both here and we both have a program today. So you know, I hear a lot of people talk from this podium about these feelings of difference that they have with their amongst their peers. I don't remember having those feelings, but what I do always remember as a child is always being hyper aware. I always wondered what other people thought about me. I don't know. I always was wondering, I guess, that self-centeredness of what you were thinking about me. And and I always had this degree of, I just always was very competitive. I always wanted to be the best at every single thing that I did. And if I was not the best at what I did, I didn't want to do it. So I was very whatever I did, I was very good at it. I was very good at gymnastics. I was very good at ballet. I was very good at tap. I did all of those things, and I did it very well. And if there was anything that I tried and I did not do it well, I quit. And that's the way I did things. So I also had a mother who pretty much pushed me to continue on with those things, and I did all of those things as long as I had to do all of those things. So pretty normal childhood, really. Drinking for me started, I went to private school. I will tell you that I was the kid that all other kids' parents, they loved, but I was also very sneaky. So I was kind of always up to no good, and so when the parents turned their backs, I was kind of putting their kid up to no good. So, you know, that's kind of very deceitful. So I also did that with my brother a lot, too. So my mother always thought that I was really good, and my brother, he got caught at every single thing that he did. So, it was, you know, I was kind of like a little devilish, you know, as a child. And, you know, I don't know, I guess that I kind of had the characteristics of an alcoholic way before I took a drink. So, went to private school, I went to public school in sixth grade, and I fell in with, they say water seeks its own level. I immediately sought out people that they looked like they were having a really good time. And so I think I started experimenting with alcohol probably around the age that most people do, 13 or 14 years of age. And I don't know why, for most people that I hear talk from this podium, Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill, that was where I kind of started my experimenting. I will say also that when I was a kid, my father used to mow the grass, and we had that Miller Genuine High Life in the fridge, and after he mowed the grass, he would drink the little pony bottles, and he would drink those, and I would also, he would let me have little sips of his beer, and, you know, he would give me the beer, and I would gulp the beer, and I would mimic what he was doing, and he would, you know, he would take a sip and be like, and so I would gulp it, and I would be like, and I would burp, and I don't know where I knew how to gulp alcohol, but I thought that was good. And I don't know if you would ask him today what kind of beer he kept in his fridge, I don't know that he would know what kind of beer he kept in his fridge, but even as a 5-year-old and a 6-year-old, I knew what kind of beer he kept in his fridge. So I don't know if that meant anything, but I knew that. But anyway, so regular experimentation of alcohol. I couldn't get it regularly, but whoever the kids were that were getting alcohol, I was hanging with those kids, and we were drinking alcohol. And so that was probably 13, 14 years of age. I know that when I was able to drive, I was hanging with the kids that were hanging around with the older kids that were getting alcohol bought for them, and they were with me in my vehicle. We used to have the carnival down here on 29, I think, where they still have the carnival. I know that one Friday night we're at the carnival. I'm drinking Strawberry Hill, Boone's Farm. The next thing I know, I'm also a blackout drinker, so I'm telling you the stories that I can recall, probably half memory because that's what I can recall of these stories. But anyway, The next thing I know, I came out of a blackout in my vehicle with a boy that I don't remember getting in my vehicle with. I was partially clothed. My pants were on. I was not clothed from the waist up, and I had people looking over into the vehicle. I had vomit on me, and pretty much I could probably wrap up my drunkalogue because it doesn't get much better than that. So, you know what I mean? My drinking just goes downhill. So, out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I call drugs alcohol enhancers because I did a lot of alcohol enhancers, and what I will tell you is that it accelerated my arrival into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I liked all of those things. And the age I was, there was a lot of experimentation, and those things were easier to and more accessible for me to get my hands on than alcohol was for me to get my hands on. So there was a lot of that going on too, as well as drinking at my age. And so I was getting involved in marijuana, I was getting involved in LSD, and cocaine and things of that nature were going on, you know, at the age of 16. There was also a lot of grain alcohol that, you know, and back then you could take some grain alcohol and stop at the local 7-Eleven and put it in with a Slurpee. And do you know what happens when you take grain alcohol and mix it in with a Slurpee? Well, grain alcohol separates. And so, but oh, well, you can still drink it. And back in those days, the cops, when you got caught with alcohol in your vehicle, the cops would just follow you to a dumpster, and they would just take, they would make you drop your alcohol, take your alcohol. You would have to throw it away in front of them, and then that was it. There weren't these strict laws that there is today. You wouldn't go to jail for a DUI. You wouldn't get into the trouble that you were getting into. So I was having a really good time, and you know, this continued on throughout high school, and my parents were very, very lenient on me, and they were very lenient on my brother because, you know, as long as we maintained good grades, as long as we had a job, you know, they gave us a lot of leniency with what we did, and so we weren't causing any problems, and I wasn't having any legal problems at the time, so we were allowed to pretty much go and come as we pleased. And so I just kept on going and doing what I was doing, and I did this all throughout high school. And you know, my qualification for dating was the guy that had the best alcohol enhancers back then. So you know, there was no talk of a breakup. There was the guy at the next field party that had the better alcohol enhancers, and, you know, I moved along. And that's how I, that was my dating. So that was it, pretty much. And when I turned 19 and I had graduated from high school, I got by pretty well. I made pretty decent grades. I started hanging out with some guys that were riding motorcycles, the guys that you don't take home to your mother and father. And as a matter of fact, I was told, do not bring them home to your mother and father. We don't approve. And so I hid a lot of what I was doing. And I really thought I had arrived in life, and I started hanging around with people that needed to carry guns on their side because they were doing things that required you to carry guns on your side. And I had stuck out one morning, and I had gone on a ride, a motorcycle ride with a few, with some people. We were actually went on a charity ride, motorcycle ride, and we were actually doing something good. Actually, it was like a Toys for Tot ride. And we actually were in Caroline County, and we were riding in a staggered formation, and we were the front bike, and we had a car behind us that tried to pass eight motorcycles on a single-lane highway, and he was drinking, and it was right before they changed the legal limit of drinking from 0.1 to 0.08, and he passed all eight motorcycles, and he clipped us going about the front motorcycle, which is who I was riding passenger with, and he clipped us going about 75, and he hit us, and the gentleman that I was riding with lost his leg on impact, and I was hit, and we were flown to Mary Washington Hospital. And they called my parents and said that I was going to, they were going to amputate my leg when they took me to the hospital. And so my mom and dad had to go to the hospital knowing that their daughter was going to lose her leg. They didn't know where I was. And so, see, that's the kind of thing that I put my parents through. That's the kind of thing that I was doing. That's the selfishness and self-centeredness, the things that we do to the people that love us. And I guess I was starting to act out in behavior like that. I didn't realize the severity. They had already started having talks with me about, because they had smelled alcohol on me, already the talks that sometimes we, that our loved ones start having with us, like, you know, why don't you not drink, or please don't drink and drive, don't, you know, but you know, you just kind of cast off that conversation. It's like, I'm young, I'm having a good time. Come on, Mom, you know. But so I never, I didn't wake up for 3 days. I still had a leg. I had 9 surgeries to keep that leg. I was lucky enough to, they were able to reattach the main artery that had been severed in my leg. I still have a leg. I'm standing here with a leg. I was lucky. God was looking out for me, obviously, and, you know, I got fortunate. Anyway, that started my love of opiates, narcotic pain medicine, and so that was another thing that I could use as an aid in drinking, and that really skyrocketed my drinking and drug use. So anyway, I'll go on. My 20s, pretty much. My daily drinking was, my drinking became daily. It became daily. Wild turkey was my drink of choice. Marijuana was something that I used on a daily basis. And pills were something that I used on a regular basis too, and I didn't see anything wrong with that. And people, when the people that you and I surrounded myself with people that were just like me, and I lived that way for a really long time, and I thought that and you, when you surround yourself with people that are just like you. You know, you can go on that way for a really long time, living that way. And when you get to the point, when I got to be about 25 years old, now, meanwhile, I'm holding down a job. You know, I left my mother and father's house pretty much when I was 19 years old. After all the surgeries were over with, I left their home. I lived on my own. I worked. I held down a job. I was self-supporting. So there's really nobody to talk to me about my drinking. And but there are people, when the people that you're drinking with and hanging around with start kind of putting the bug in your ear about your drinking, well, you know, then I just get new people. I need new people. So you start running through people in your life, and, you know, and then it gets pretty, your world starts getting pretty small. And I kind of need to move along. I don't want to stay here. I have a tendency to stay drunk for a long time. I'm going to kind of get close to what happened here. My 20s went on like that. It was pretty much Groundhog Day. I got up doing pretty much the same thing for a really long time. And so I got to the point where I had a good job, and I had worked at the same place for about 6 years, and I had taken a different position in that job, and it was a really bad move for me. And I moved underneath of a supervisor that we were hanging out and drinking together on the weekends, and her drinking looked a lot like my drinking. And but what had happened when I moved underneath of her as a supervisor, we were having a lot of clashes personality-wise, and she, but when it came to whether it was going to be her or me, it was going to be me. And so she went to the bosses about me, and though I was what I thought a pretty decent employee at that company, it was me. And they escorted me out of that building, no thought of what kind of employee I was, and I lost my job. And at the same time that this was occurring, I had applied to go back to college, and I had gotten accepted to college, but I did not know this until about a week after losing my job. So I didn't realize that this had happened, but this was right before my entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous. My drinking was pretty much at an all-time low. I was 28 years old, and I had moved back home with my mother and father well beyond the age that a child should be living with their mother and father in a basement. And I will tell you that I was in and out of my mother and father's home in my late 20s, in my early 30s, and in my late 30s as well. So I would tell you that I was self-supporting and had a home, but when you're living in your parents' basement, I pretty much could consider myself homeless. So that was probably the truth of the matter. And thank God for them, because I harmed them more than anybody else that I could harm during my active years of drinking. So, God bless them. They're good people. And so anyway, emotionally, my brother had started going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings because he had had some really serious legal problems that he had gotten himself into right around the time that I had lost my job. And I knew that I was starting to have some problems with my drinking. And I don't think it was any coincidence. But, you know, sometimes, even though I was in full, you know, flight from reality, and I was, you know, drinking on a daily basis, I really had noticed that there were some changes in his life that were occurring, and he was not the same person that I used to drink with, you know, when we did drink together. And so I knew I had to do something different in my life. And it wasn't an accident that the time came that when I needed to go to my first meeting, that he was the person that I asked to go to take me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so he did. And he took me to my very first AA meeting in Culpeper, Church on the Rise, and being the self-centered alcoholic that I am, I figured that he made some calls. He let everybody know that I was coming to the meeting, and I had never been to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting before. And you know how we do when a newcomer comes for the first time. We talk about the first step. And so I thought that you guys, you know, knew I was coming. I thought you had changed your stories to make it sound like he had told you about my drinking. And I thought that you had changed your stories to kind of sound like my drinking. You knew about my drinking and what I was doing out there. And so I thought you made it sound like, you know. So I thought you sounded a lot like me, but you know what? That wasn't what the case was, you know. So you just shared about you, and it sounded a lot like me, and so it's that spirit of identification. So you were really nice to me. I said that I was an alcoholic out of my mouth. I don't know that I believed it, but whatever you shared with me that night. It made me want to come back to another meeting. A bunch of ladies gave me their phone number. You gave me a where and when, and I came back for another meeting. And I came back, actually. I picked up a chip, a 24-hour chip, and I came back. I came back for about 2 months. I picked up a one-month chip. I picked up a two-month chip. I changed nothing about myself. I didn't want to change the people. I didn't want to change the places. I didn't want to change the things. I changed nothing about myself. And I stayed for about 5 months, and I left. And I didn't come back. And, you know, and I brought all my bad barroom skills right into Alcoholics Anonymous with me. Some of you are sitting here tonight that saw me when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't ready. But you were really kind, and you told me to keep coming back. You told me about the not yets that were going to happen to me if I kept on drinking. And that was, you know, you know, that's what we do here at Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of us are ready and some of us aren't ready, and I wasn't ready back then. So during that period of time, my brother was helping a young man here in the program. Might have been right before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. That young man would call the house and Greg wouldn't be there sometimes, but I would pick up the phone, and it would be a late night. And for some reason, he started to talk to me about his problems. And I would be like, "Do you think you could call back at a later time? Like I'm like maybe like 9 or 10 in the morning. I'm, you know." And that young man, is now my husband. He stopped calling to. Talked to my brother, and he started calling to talk to me. And it didn't take us long to start hanging out with one another, and it didn't take us long to meet one another and not do the program and start drinking with one another. So that did not end well, and both of us stayed gone for quite some time out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came back and I went to treatment in September of 2005. I had gone back to college. I had gone through college. I graduated in December of 2004, and I finished in 2004. I graduated in 2005. In May of 2005, who gets arrested in the driveway of their home? Mm-hmm. I get arrested in the driveway of my home. It took me 1 month of graduating college to get arrested, and the not yets that you had described that would happen in my life as a result of my drinking had started to occur. You don't come uninvited to places where you're not wanted, and I did. It wasn't my home at the time, but I came uninvited, and so I had drugs on me, and I was intoxicated, and the policeman asked to search my car, and I had hid everything underneath of my floorboard, and I didn't think he would find it, and he asked to search my vehicle, and I was convinced he wouldn't find it, and I said yes, and he found it in less than 3 seconds, and so I went to jail. And I don't take good mug shots. And I lost my job at the school system. And so I went to jail that night. And a career that I had started in college, gone as a direct result of my drinking. So anyway, I went to treatment. And I'd like to tell you that I was done drinking. But I probably wasn't out of ideas, and I probably just wanted to delay. I wanted it to look good in court when I went to court in front of the judge. And so I went to treatment in Winchester, Virginia in 2005, and I came home, and the judge could care less. And so I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous with my tail between my legs, and I came here, and I was on probation, and I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and as soon as I was not on supervised probation, I started with a marijuana maintenance program in these rooms, and I picked up chips for 3 years, and I did... I actually did not, I picked up chips for 3 years that way. And my parents came to my first year of my anniversary. They sat in my home group in Rapidan. They cried. They were very so excited for me. And I stood at the front of the room crying. But they were crying for a different reason that I was crying, you know. And, you know, to be a phony in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, if anybody's doing that, it just, you know, it almost killed me. It really did. And that right there alone, to live that way, I had no other option. You know, I would leave work and... you know, not to put you on blast, but Billy would give me speaker CDs. He would come from a conference. He would give me speaker CDs of all these wonderful speakers, Bob, Daryl, all of these great speakers. And I would leave work and I would listen to all these speakers. I had an hour drive. I would listen to them. I would get high. I would think about all these fabulous things I was going to share in a meeting when I was going to go to the meeting that night. And you know what marijuana does to short-term memory loss. So all these fabulous things that I was going to share at the meeting, I would lose it by the time I got back to Culpeper. You know what I mean? And then I'd have to lay down for a little while because I have to, like, Visine, lay down, eat. You know what I mean? So I wouldn't be high when I went to the meeting at 8 o'clock that night. And it was like, you know, just to live that way. And then, you know, sometimes people would come up to you. You know, I'd sit on the back row of the meeting and be like, are you okay, Dana? You look really tired. You know, something's not right with Dana. You know, something, what is going on with her? And you know, I'd be like, I'm okay. Or, you know, you just wouldn't share. And what other option did I have but in November 13th, Friday the 13th, I got in such an emotional tailspin that, and I have to share this because it's freaking hilarious for me. It's so hilarious. I'm at Dale's house. I go there after work, and, you know, he's got natural light because he's trying to taper off on his drinking, so he's drinking the light stuff. So I have a natural light in my hand, and I've got it out, and I'm like, and he's in the bathroom, and I take it in there, and I've got it in my hand, and he grabs my hand like this, and I'm like, oh, he cares, you know, and he's like, you're not going to drink my beer, you know, so I just like, was like, shoot, you know what I mean, like, so anyway, I drank the beer, and, I drank four beers, and I was gone, passed out. So anyway, that one night of drinking, and I was not going to come back to AA. One night of drinking, and I was done with Alcoholics Anonymous. And for some reason, I made a phone call that day, the next day, and to another alcoholic in the rooms, and they were like, so what? Brush yourself off, pick yourself up, go to a freaking meeting. You're an alcoholic. You drank. So what? You know what I mean? Get honest. And I went to a meeting that night, and I got honest. And with all my arrogance and all my pride, I went to the meeting, hands crossed, sitting at the table. I was like, you know what? I don't want to hear anything from anybody. I drank. So what? Give me a chip. And, you know, and so I started my journey over again. And although I didn't get honest about the marijuana smoking for the last 3 years, do you know it took me another year to get honest about my smoking marijuana, but I finally came clean, and you know what? I talk about it often. I talk about it all the time, smoking pot for 3 years, because I know there's a lot of people that use other substances, but because they don't drink, they say they're sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. So I talk about it. People probably get sick about hearing about it, but it's my journey, and so I talk about it often, you know, and I can say, honestly, I haven't had any mood, emotion, mind-altering substances since November 14th of 2008. And so that's what it is. So let me talk about, you know, what this journey is, what it's like today for me. You know, step one, you know, I'm powerless over alcohol. God knows I'm powerless over alcohol. I've tried in every single way I could to control this thing. You know, when I'm controlling my drinking, I'm not having a damn bit of fun when I'm trying to control my drinking. I can't do it, you know, and my life is completely unmanageable, and today, my life can be unmanageable, and the reason it gets unmanageable is because I'm the one that's trying to run the show. And I can still go there. And that's what I shared at the beginning of the meeting, that sometimes I'll have something happen. It always happens right before, for some reason, when I'm getting ready to share from the podium, a little reminder that, Dana, there's always work that you can be doing to, you know, to always better maintain your spiritual fitness, you know. And that's what it is. The second step, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. There's a line in We Agnostics, one of my favorite lines in the book, that God doesn't make too hard of terms on those who seek him. That, for me, was one of the most powerful lines in the book, in the big book, because that was where I made a beginning in my journey with that loving God. Because I didn't want to hear about God when I got here. I didn't want to hear about it. I was raised in a pretty liberal church. I didn't have anything about anything against God. The fact of the matter was, is once I started drinking on a daily basis, I didn't think God loved me. Didn't think that he really cared about me. As a matter of fact, I blamed him for every single thing, every decision that I made, and that's why I didn't really want to hear about God when I got to AA, you know. So it was all me. It clearly, I had things happen in my life. That accident that occurred, you know, when I was, you know, 19 years old, clearly there was something looking at for me that was bigger than me, that obviously believed that I needed to be here for something greater in my life than to take me out, you know, off this planet when I was a young girl, you know. So I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And, you know, I had a really hard time with that. And what I was told by my first sponsor is that, can you make a decision to go through the rest of the steps? Can you, until you get to that place where you realize that, until you believe, can you make a decision to go through this process, to go through 4 through 12? Can you do that? And since I have gone through that process, and now that I do believe in something bigger than me, I know in my heart that it's always best for me to turn my life over and my actions over to something bigger than me. It always works better that way than Dana doing this thing on her own, you know? So, in the fourth step, you know, I have to say, you know, it just shows how absolutely insane I was, you know, when I made that first, when I did that first fourth step, I was convinced that this was going to be my shot at making a list of all the people that had done me wrong. And there was going to be a lady that was going to do a checklist for me and say, oh, you were right, Dana. Look at all these people. You know what I mean? You had a reason to be upset with all these people. Look what they did to you. And it just wasn't the case. You know, what I realized is that I had a part in every single one of those names that I put down on there. And I have certainly had to go down and do, because for this alcoholic, I have had, because resentments for me, they're certainly the number one offender, and they can certainly crop up in my life. And so I have had to do more than one fourth and fifth step. You know, for me, especially with my first sponsor, it was almost like a yearly thing. It was a house cleaning that had to be done on a regular basis, you know, until I learned how to practice the 10th step on a more regular basis. You know, take a look at that stuff on a daily basis. You don't have to continually do, you know, you don't have to continually look at that stuff on a regular basis. So, and the fifth step for me about admitting that to God and to ourselves and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs, you know, when I did finally sit down and I got rid of that fear of actually having to, you know, sit down with a lady and get honest about that list and, you know, the things I had done that I thought were so horrible and that I was so unique and that nobody could have ever done those things. And that when she's nodding her head and, you know, they had done the same things or they had done worse things, that is the first time that I felt like I really belonged here. You know, that I felt a part of this fellowship, that, okay, I belong here. You know, 6 and 7, that's an ongoing thing. You know, when I first went through the steps, I perused right over those. And what I'm realizing is that is a lifelong process. You know, my defects of character and my shortcomings, I mean, really, that's something that I am always, always going to have to deal with. And, you know, they're not going to be removed when I'm ready for them to be removed. They're probably not going to be, they're not going to get removed if I keep acting out on them. So, you know, my amends, they came from my fourth step list. And all of my amends were well received. Everybody, the biggest thing that happened in my amends, you know, going through the amends were the biggest thing that I had from everybody. The request that I got the most was that people wanted me to participate in their life. because I hadn't participated in their life for so long. You know, they wanted to see me. They wanted to be a part of, they wanted me to be a part of their life. And that was the thing that, that was the thing that, that they said the most. And, you know, and I can do that today. I can be a part of their life. So I have to continually take a look at my, what I'm doing on a daily basis. Like I said, I have to continually take a look at what I'm doing, because I can get, if I don't start my day off with prayer, I can get out of whack. That's how my day works best when I, 10 and 11 is very much linked for me. I need to really, I need to tell you a little bit about, you know, I've had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I didn't like women when I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't like anybody, actually, because I didn't like me. And one of the biggest gifts of my recovery is that I have a sponsor, and God has put women in my life to work with, ladies that I get to work with, and they really are a blessing. That saves me more than anything else, is getting to work with other women. It really does. You know, most of you know, they really saved me. You know, I got married in 12-12-12. I didn't know whether I was going to talk about this or not. It has been, some of you were there. You gave your blessing. It's been tough. And because of this disease, my marriage has fallen apart. And, you know, and I'm standing here at the podium sober today. And I those women on the days when I just don't have the time, I don't want to do it, I can't say no, because people that have made time for me, you know, they've given freely to me. Why would I not give freely to them? You know what I mean? I need them so much that, you know, we just, and, you know, I said, I don't know if I said, but on, in my home group on Tuesday nights, we do a step in tradition meeting, and we just finished reading the fourth step. And, it says in there that our basic problem is this, you know, that we have this inability to form a true partnership with another individual. And, you know, that is something that still, you know, today I have to take a look at. And because of this fellowship, I have learned how to become, you know, a daughter, a friend, a wife, a worker. I mean, just all of those things. And we don't realize, you know, this fellowship doesn't just give us the tools to be able to stay sober. I mean, it gives us life skills to be able to not just, I mean, to practice principles of life, you know, in other areas of, in all areas of living. And so, you know, I'm just so grateful that I just really would have shortchanged myself if I just thought that this program was going to teach me, you know, how to not drink one day at a time. you know, it just, I really would have really, you know, this fellowship is really a miracle. And as far as my husband, you know, he's still writing his story. I pray for him every day. That's what we do here, you know. And I do that one day at a time too. So I thank you for letting me come up and share with you tonight. And you know, if you didn't get anything out of my share, be encouraged. There'll be another speaker here next week. That's all I have to say tonight. Thank you.